Okay, thanks. Right, so yes, I was asked to talk about potential vorticity staircases. So this is going to be a summary of my recent work. As Gavin just pointed out, this isn't an entirely unbiased list of references, but it wasn't meant to be comprehensive. It was just partly just to draw attention to, well, this is my previous work, and also to mention my co-authors, so Tim Dunkert and David Ritchell and Anne-Sophie Tissier, who was a student working with me a couple of years ago. Oops. So if any of this, if anything's not clear, just don't hesitate to butt in. I'm going to go over the just very basic ideas, and this should just be a few slides, and then go on to some more specific examples. So one thing that I'll look at is, which is basically the results of these two earlier papers. This was this special issue on jets that resulted from a Chapman conference on jets a while back. So just the nice result that when you do have a perfect potential vorticity staircase, you can say exactly what the jet spacing is in terms of the Rhine scale. Okay, but then that begs the question about when do you actually see potential vorticity staircases in reality, in nature, or in numerical simulations or experiments. So that's what we looked at in the JFM paper a couple of years ago. And then sort of extending that, you can, I mean, all this is really the situation where the forcing is at small scales, but there's no reason why you should restrict to that case, except that often jets are discussed in terms of the halting of the inverse energy cascade by the Rhine scale. So the point is you don't really need an inverse energy cascade. So this paper looked at large scale forcing and the differences that come up. So if there's time or interest, we can mention some other ideas that follow on from this. So all of this is going to be in the context of a single layer model, QG, shallow water, on the beta plane. So this is the equation that Gavin introduced on Tuesday, I think, the Charney-Hasegawa-Mima equation, or QG shallow water equation. And everything I'm going to do is going to ignore this term. So I'm going to have LD going to infinity. OK, so it's the barotropic vorticity equation. So just drop that term. And then there are sort of three fundamental properties of the system. So one is that this the background gradient of potential vorticity supports Rossby waves. And that means that if you have, well, you have horizontal or longitudinal contours of potential vorticity, if you try to perturb those, what will happen is that the flow will develop waves, which will propagate. So those waves will resist any lateral displacements of potential vorticity contours. And that resistance is stronger where the potential vorticity gradients are stronger. Okay, so strong potential vorticity gradients provide an elasticity to lateral displacements, meridional or latitudinal displacements. Okay, and then the second thing is the potential vorticity inversion. So if you're given a potential vorticity profile, you can invert this equation with suitable boundary conditions to get the stream function that gives you your flow. Okay, so any regions of strong potential vorticity gradients, because of this inversion, tend to be associated with positive or eastward jets. Okay, and then the third thing, so when you have these jets, there's another mechanism, so that you get strong shear. Okay, it's going to get. Oh, I'll either have to go quicker. No, I'm not plugged in. I'll try to remember to keep reminding it. So when you have the strong, if you have jets, then you have shear on the jet flanks, and that shear tends to stretch out eddies and will prevent them from strongly disturbing the jets. So there's another mechanism that basically tries to keep the jets where they are and stop the eddies from influencing them. So in addition to the elasticity, so this is the Kelvin shear disturbances. So and the result of all these is basically that whenever you have any mixing, it's organized into regions where the potential vorticity is weak, and it's inhibited in regions where the potential vorticity is strong. Okay, so there's a positive feedback. And these ideas are not mine. These go back to McIntyre in 82, Marcus in 93. And there were related ideas even earlier than that, the Phillips ideas in stratified flow. Okay, so what does this look like? So basically, you start from a background potential vorticity gradient. If you have turbulence or eddies, waves and eddies, but still your mean vorticity gradient is flat, the point is this is an unstable profile. Any mixing that will flatten the gradient in some region will tend to then be concentrated in that region, and mixing will be inhibited from the strong gradients that appear on either side. So any mixing regions will tend to develop and steepen on the flanks, right? So and then that's the zonal mean velocity profile that's associated with that.
Can I ask a kind of naive question?
Yeah.
You just said this flow is unstable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is it unstable?
Well, in the sense that this gradient is unstable, this will not persist. The background potential vorticity gradient. It's not unstable in a linear
sense. Doesn't the gradient have to reverse to the end?
No, I'm not talking about shear instabilities. I just mean that, so you got some turbulent flow. If this is the back, think of this as a background gradient. All right, so zonal average, the gradient is. The mixing itself will tend to organize into distinct regions. Okay, so this gradient here will not persist. It will develop into something that looks like this.
That's what Srinivasan and Jung would call zonostrophic instability.
Right, yes.
The tendency of a turbulent state in that background PV potential to go unstable to jets. But there's some other mechanism that's generating the eddy motion.
We're assuming that the eddies are there already.
Turbulence.
Well, we're assuming there's turbulence or waves existing, pre-existing.
Yeah.
Is there analytic theory of such instability?
No.
Well, it's a statistical analysis.
You
can take a turbulent intensity, slowly modify it, and then see if it grows.
Yeah.
So some kind of...
Yeah, it would be...
You can do like modulational
instabilities. But of it, like a turbulent spectra, you could do modulation stability. Now you just have this better term, and you have a modulational stability modified into something.
But I mean, you could say, give me a spectrum, and I add a test shear, which is set by beta term, and then see, does that produce growth of modulation?
Right. Like in kinetic equation for waves, you just can have modulation stability of spectra.
Right.
And I wonder if it depends on how wide is the spectrum of turbulence. Because normally we know that if you have turbulent spectra, they are modulationally stable when they are sufficiently wide. And here I wonder whether there will be any competition between beta and the width of the spectra with this instability.
Sure,
it's
there might be.
Academic question.
You are talking about the really initial step.
Let's take homogeneous turbulence and slowly modify it and see if this modulation grows.
Right.
And that would depend on the spectrum of turbulence in K space.
So the results I'll show at the end support that. There's a limit on the scale of the forcing.
There is an extraordinary theory of the staircase themselves. When the systems have reached stationary states, then it's a lot of theoretical questions that can be addressed.
Well, you can certainly say, it's not the answer to your question, you can certainly say that if you have a flow of one scale and then you look for modulation in this background, then it depends very sensitively on the scale.
Absolutely, that's clear. Okay. Well, it's multi-scale turbulence, then it's something which would probably be determined by the width of the scale.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's the peak of the maximum.
Of course, if it's spectrum like this, but imagine that there is a spectrum which is a power law in some region, right? So it has a large scale and small scale. I guess that the large scale probably would be crucial here with the most energy. But again, I mean, it's something which is must be obtained from zero.
That's right.
So if you just take this argument and assume that these mixing the regions where the potential vorticities mixed are growing and keep growing, they grow as far as they can, you get to the staircase profile. So the point is this: these regions can't overmix because that would be a shear unstable profile. Okay, but so that this is sort of a limiting situation, and the velocity field associated with that is as these strong eastward jets at the potential vorticity jumps, and then a parabolic, piecewise parabolic profile in between. Okay, so the staircase solution, if you simply take this potential vorticity profile, find the U associated with that, you come up with a very simple relation between the spacing between the jets and the Rhine scale if you base the Rhine scale on this peak jet velocity. So in this system, that's the only velocity to take. In a turbulent system, you might take an RMS velocity, but here this is the peak velocity is the only velocity in the system, so that gives a sort of unique Rhine scale. And we find that the jet spacing, or this is actually the half separation between two eastward jets, is root 3 times the Rhine scale.
Okay.
U max is the maximum velocity here. This is 0. That's U max.
So here you define the Rhine scale, not with the average velocity.
So if you take the average velocity, you can take URMS, you get an additional factor of 5 to the quarter, some other power here. It changes the number, but it doesn't change the theory.
So
there's a unique relation between the maximum and the RMS here.
Do you mean that there is a C correlation between the average velocity and the RMS velocity?
In this case, yeah. I mean, because we're considering an basically an axisymmetric flow here. So all the U is in that profile.
What do you call the what do you mean exactly?
It's just the RMS of this profile.
Yeah, so
there are no eddies in this. This is axisymmetric. Parallel flow.
In this thought experiment, you imagine you're starting off with a constant gradient with a turbulent eddy field,
yeah.
So it's an energy.
Yeah.
So maybe that energy should be used to define the RMS flow?
Sure, well, that energy will basically determine, yes, it's the same, yeah. but in the strong staircase limit, all of the energy goes into the zone of flow.
So that's the same, the energy of the final flow is the same as what's hypothesized?
Yes,
So all what you say is just the induction.
Yes. Yeah. That's all. There's nothing
so
fancy here.
So all the heating energy,
uh-huh.
at the beginning has been converted into the zonal energy.
Yes, that's the basic assumption here.
Just ask quickly. So
yeah.
What did turn? I mean, is you don't know the Rhine scale until you know U max. So how do you?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to add the question.
So I mean, it's not a closed answer.
Well, it is. If you start with an initial field, as Gavin says, with a known energy.
Which is initial energy in the turbulent field, which can be used to define U, and that's the same as the RMS energy.
The energy is conserved. So
it gives you the same value as the final jet, because it's an assumption that all of that energy goes into the jet in this thought experiment.
And this assumption is supported by data?
Well, we haven't done freely decaying. I'm going to show you forced experiments, so it's not the. No, I mean this is a picture of what might happen. Yeah, and if you're in the staircase regime, then your jets and your Rhine scale are diagnostically related like that.
What maintains the jets if they are? Do you take into account viscous damping here, or you are a layer?
No. This is. No, I mean we're not thinking at that level of physical mechanisms.
So you don't think these jets, you don't assume any damping; they can stay forever.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So this is not a hermetic system.
No, I'm not going. Yeah. Well, it's high Reynolds number. I think.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Any bottom drag?
No. I'm going to talk about drag when we talk about this sort of approach to this limit.
You can modify this whole argument in force per force.
Yeah. So just a word of caution to people who are in the journal club tomorrow. I think this is the paper that's going to be under discussion. So you're going to see different numbers here. it all depends on what you, how you define your Rhine scale. I think in Dritchell and McIntyre, the U is the peak to trough velocity, so you're going to get a root 2 here. In Dunkard and Scott, we got a root 6 because we define things differently.
What you get if you, you know, use, say, the URMS from the initial eddy field, which would be, in some sense, the most principled definition, I think.
Right, so URMS from the initial eddy field is going to be the same as the URMS here, because energy is conserved. And in that case, so if you take URMS here, you multiply this by 5 to the quarter, okay. I think, if I remember rightly. It's just a different constant. So there's, yeah, slightly bigger. This is all very basic, and it's not, you know, to be applied directly to real flows. So you can ask, when do you actually ever see a staircase forming? So this is a staircase in the stratosphere on the 580 Kelvin potential temperature surface in the winter. So you do see this. So this is longitude and latitude going up here. This is the surf zone, so very well mixed surf zone. And this is the potential vorticity profile. It's actually done in an area coordinate. But it basically picks out the high gradients at the polar vortex edge and at the equatorial edge of the surf zone. So you see somewhat of a staircase there. I mean, it's not an exact staircase. This is from, well, it's from reanalysis. It's from a model. So you can ask, what general conditions do you actually see these staircases forming? What's that?
It simulates numerical calculations really well.
The reanalysis? Yes. Okay, so I'm going to go over to the force case now. If we assume forcing, I mean, this is relevant to atmospheres. I've been talking about Rhine scale, and it's related to the jet scale, but whenever you have forcing, you can think of another length scale based on the energy injection rate, epsilon and beta. So this was introduced in Ballas and Maltrud. They called it L beta. We prefer L epsilon simply because L beta appears in both of these, so it's not very informative. So that we think of this as a forcing length scale associated with the forcing, so L epsilon. And then, so we did a numerical study in this paper, and basically we just varied L Rhines over L epsilon, and we find that you get strong jets in the staircase limit when this number, this ratio of length scales, is large.
What is the mechanism of forcing?
Well, so it doesn't matter. We looked at different forcings. We looked at spectral narrowband forcing. We also looked at broadband physical space forcing, and you get the same thing. Okay.
Does the force have its own lengths? So what the typical lengths was maybe of the force?
Yeah. So okay.
It's barely,
right. It's not really okay. Good. Okay. So that's important. So at this point, we're assuming the forcing is at small scales. Okay. Later, I'll show you cases where forcing is at large scales. Because if the forcing scale is important, you've got three length scales, and you've got more than one dimensionless number. So we want to look at the simplest system. So we assume that the box is big enough, so the box scale is not important, and the forcing is small enough so that the forcing scale is not important. Then this is the only dimensionless parameter in the system.
So it's smaller than either L epsilon.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to clarify, in this case, the Rhine scale isn't quite an honest parameter because it's got the RMS velocity.
Yeah.
The final jet scale. So in fact, it's actually controlled by something like the friction in the system.
Yes. Right. Yes and no. So I'll show you that. This is going to go more than 15 minutes.
Rhine scale, just to remind us the definition of Rhine scale.
Rhine scale?
From the previous. So how big actually? Okay, it's also in the animator.
Okay, so now in what follows, this is going to be URMS, okay, because we don't know what the jet's velocity is a priori. But we can fix URMS. So L epsilon is
Because URMS somehow is related to epsilon as well, right?
Yes, you can combine it.
The scale of force in a conductor relation there.
Yeah, so we're assuming that the scale is small.
Isn't one of the scales there, I guess it's the Rhine scale, masquerading really for the scale of some properties of the damping field?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be
yes and no?
I mean, the way this is written, it seems it's a ratio of two things that are fundamentally attacking the same thing.
Yes, for now, but in 5 minutes, the answer will be different. So, in this study, so you're right. So there's forcing, energy rate epsilon, and damping a rate r, and the ratio of those fixes your RMS, your energy, okay? So what we do is we fix this ratio, so our Rhine scale is always the same, all right? But our L epsilon is changing, and therefore our ratio is changing. Okay, that's how we do it here.
Can you see this ratio as a ratio of time scale?
Yeah, you can recast it in terms of time scale.
I think, too, that the Rhine scale, and the thing to keep in mind here is the beta has to do with the wave part, right? So the waves, mean flow sort of thing. Right? There's waves, it's not just damping, right? It's the wave part. It's where the wave part is doing something important, right? Rhine scale?
Yeah, that's the
more fundamental way to look at it. And so I think we're getting lost in the damping here.
Let me say one last word on the damping, and then we'll move on. So what I'm going to show you in the second part is that you can do away with this term altogether, right? You can simply measure your Rhine scale, okay, at any one instant. You can think of a quasi-stationary situation where you're injecting energy at a uniform rate in time. Your overall energy is growing in time. This parameter, or the ratio of these parameters, evolve very slowly, like t^1/4, and you just look at the quasi-stationary case. So the friction doesn't play an important dynamical role. Here it's important because we're simply using it to set the final energy. Okay, but you don't have to. It's not important dynamically.
What confuses me here is that if I look at turbulence, then usually URMS is epsilon times L, which is a scale of forcing, it's the power to third. If I plug it into your definition of Rhine scale, I get the same kind of, epsilon, which is, and it's not about dissipation, it's just that I would get epsilon, U would be epsilon to third, and it will be, again, ratio of epsilon to beta. So I'm
but these are independent in this case. They're not, they don't reduce to the same.
They depend as long as you write the force scale.
Here we're
seeing URMS and epsilon are related through the force scale.
Okay. No, here they're related through R.
The URMS is really RMS of the final jet.
Well, in the case where it depends on whether you've got strong jets or not. So, let me just try and how much longer do I?
Well,
yeah, it's
fine.
Okay, it's fine.
It's good.
Okay, so this is just to illustrate the dependence on this parameter. So, all that's changing is this dimensionless number. It's small here. What we call small is 3. It's large here, and so in other words, so this is a strong forcing case, and this is a very weak forcing case, which gives these numbers. And you can just about make out the jets here. It's obviously a very turbulent flow. There's lots of potential vorticity mixing, but it's not mixing into strong staircasing. In this case, you're very hard pressed to see actually any turbulent mixing going on, but it's done it. Done the job already. So this is the potential vorticity anomaly, by the way. So Q minus beta y. So this uniform gradient here is actually flat potential vorticity, the uniform potential vorticity.
So just to make it clear, Richard, so both of those flows have the same RMS?
Yes, yeah.
Which is that in the right-hand one, it's all in the mean?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah. And we can we've diagnosed that in terms of, you know, we can define a jet component of the flow and an eddy component of the flow, and almost all the energy in this case is in the jets. Here it's mostly in the eddies.
So does that go into what you said at the very beginning of your talk, that when you have strong gradients of PEV, you prevent mixing?
Yeah.
And so it's why you call that strong forcing, you get a lot of turbulence?
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, I mean, you get the forcing is at small scales, it's creating eddies at small scales. They're of sufficient intensity that they don't, compared with the gradients, that they don't really care about the gradients. They can pass through, they can disrupt them. In the other case, you know, if you put down an eddy here, it's just going to be sheared out by the jets. It will have very little impact. Okay, so that's when you get staircasing.
The same in each case, or what determines the strength of the zonal flow?
So the zonal flow is here. This is the potential vorticity. Again, this is an area coordinate, but you can think of it as a zonal mean. And you get very strong jets at the jumps in potential vorticity.
Would some of those little jets merge in that simulation?
Well, they tend not to. They look like they might be about to merge, but they persist for a very long time. And also, so here you've got two jets. The return flow is always positive. There's a jet associated with this jump, but because it's in a region of negative flow, it doesn't have an absolute positive velocity. Anyway.
Also, the one on the right takes, right, because you've got it, T is 10 over R, so it takes an awful long time to get to that.
Oh, yeah, the time scaling depends on the friction.
Right, so you're measuring them at that comparable time and scale.
Here, basically, you solve Hessian mean equations with a force, right?
Yeah, infinite deformation radius as well.
And so about this force, you assume that it's a random force, right?
Yeah.
So you assume some typical scale and some correlation time to maintain the epsilon, right?
So, potential entropy or entropy dynamics is
important. We inject
the potential entropy.
Yes. So, here I don't think there's. It's really important as long as the forcing is at small scales. There's not a very big dependence. It's basically all eddy mixing. If we get onto the later stuff, there are different mixing regimes that you get into when you have large scale. So there are some cases where the mixing is basically done in large critical layers, and others where it's mostly small scale eddies. Okay. I don't really want to talk very much about spectra here. These spectra don't. Well, the main thing we decompose the spectra into. The jet and eddy components, and most of this is in the weak forcing case. Most of the energy, by far, is in the jet field. The spectra themselves aren't very informative. Okay, I'm going to skip over quantifying the staircase. We did lots of simulations, and basically. Strong staircasing is up here, weak staircasing is down here, and they all show the general trend that when you increase L rhines over L epsilon, you get stronger stair casing. So it's, it seems to be a robust result. And that was for different forcing types as well.
How did you was that scan accomplished basically by varying the frictional damping?
And the forcing and the forcing together.
And the forcing. Yeah. It would be, I mean, it would be interesting to do it at fixed forcing and just vary the damping alone.
Well, then, but
the, ratio
yeah, so
the, scales with the fractional power of the damping.
No, but the problem is then, so you, your Rhine scale is changing, and if you're doing this in a box, your Rhine scale is going to change over large range. You're going from situations where you have one or two jets in the domain to where you have hundreds of jets in the domain, and resolving that is a pain in the neck. Right? So, so we're doing this for
the small this, scan. I mean, where you don't go from 2 to 100.
Yeah, but remember, there's this power of 1/5, and really, it means you have to change these numbers over a large range to get.
The dependence on the damping should only come the square root, I think. Because that comes
through the ratio of these numbers?
Yeah.
R to the half.
So I don't think it's that hard. It might be.
Yeah, but I think I still think it's. You can do it if you want.
But I mean, the only sensible thing in that ratio of L beta and L Rhine's way of looking at it is to look at it as looking at somehow the ratio of the wave turbulence crossover to sort of the way of the friction, the effect of the frictional damping. So it would seem logical to try to scan the damping alone.
I think it makes more sense to look at a situation where you have the same number of jets in your domain. I mean, it's, but maybe it's subjective.
You have three parameters and your box is fixed. So you have two independent non-dimensional parameters. So
Well, in the last case, I'm assuming the box is large enough. It's larger than any of the other scales, and the forcing is smaller than any of the other scales.
It is large enough to what?
To the Rhine scale and L epsilon.
Yeah, if you want to get the expense is supposed to be in the
region. Okay, so.
Sorry, this is kinetic energy.
Yeah, that's all there is. Yeah. Okay, so if there's time still.
Yeah,
the only thing is, so I want to talk about when this the forcing scale becomes important. All right, so I'm assuming that there's a domain scale here, big L, which is bigger than all of these and isn't important. And in the previous experiments, we assumed that this forcing scale was small enough that it wasn't important. But what happens when these three are all comparable? This is the sort of picture that's been shown for jet formation. Typically, you think of the forcing at very small scales and an inverse energy cascade in an isotropic regime up to k epsilon, the wave number associated with L epsilon, and then the steepening to the jet regime. And so you get this jet regime where these are when these are well separated. Okay, but what happens when we bring that kf inside? Inside this range, and actually it doesn't make much difference. So this paper looked at the more general case where KF is smaller, and I guess I won't spend long on this, but this is the point I was making. You can dispense with friction altogether if you're prepared to live with a quasi-stationary regime. Okay, so we just consider forced and undamped. L Rhine's grows like t to the 1/4. Now there's no friction parameter. The evolution is slow, so the flow has time to adjust at any given Rhine scale. And there's one other thing we did differently, which was we, instead of just putting an additive forcing on the right-hand side, we included the forcing as a sort of topographic forcing in the potential vorticity. And this was necessary to retain material conservation of potential vorticity in the regimes that we're looking at. So things get a little tricky. So we've got three lengths, and we can think of two dimensionless parameters, L Rhine's over L epsilon, as we just had, and then also the ratio of L Rhine's to L forcing. So we've got a two-dimensional parameter space, and the quasi-stationary simulations allow us to sweep out lines in this parameter space. So it's also a numerical expedient where we can cut down the number of independent parameters. So here we're interested in this region down here, where L forcing is on the same order of L Rhines, but still this number is still large. And basically, again, in that regime, I'll just skip over these, you get one example, you get very strong staircasing. This is the full potential vorticity, and you see the strong jumps there. This is the red profile, it's almost a perfect staircase. Okay, and that's with L Rhines over LF equals 1. Okay, so the forcing does not have to be at small scales. So there's no inverse energy cascade needed in this situation. But this number still has to be big.
So in that case, L Rhines is about a quarter of the box or something?
Yeah, yeah.
So it really is large scale.
Well, it is getting close to the box scale, but we're...
Both of those...
If it gets even bigger...
Well, actually, both of those got small. Yeah, lots and lots of jets,
uh-huh.
But you were still on the
small scale. I think, so if you just doubled the box size here, I don't think this would change. Yeah.
This is a snapshot, right? And these boundaries, they keep moving in time?
Yeah, the jets are surprisingly steady in all of these cases. They tend not to meander.
The picture, for example, at the top right.
Uh-huh.
Of that shape.
Oh, this, yes, it propagates. Yeah, there are waves, always waves on the jets.
When the forcing is very, very small, what is the size of the jets? Is it 4 of the epsilon or 4 of the Rhine?
The size of the jets?
The width. Here,
the width, well, we're close to the staircase limit, so we know, right? The jet scale is approximately root 3 times the Rhine scale. Yeah.
So the jets don't meander around precisely because that number is 11.
I think the reason that the jets, and if Bill Young were here, he'd say more about it, is because of the symmetry. There's no...
translation.
Yeah, it's translationary invariant in Y. If you change that, then you...
But if you L Rhines over epsilon was small, then you presumably get more
meandering. So even in the case back here, where was it? This one. Even in this case, these jets don't tend to wander around much.
They're still quite large. But
yeah. We flew to a little bit, but yeah.
You should,
it's not.
So when you say you're going to go to coffee.
Okay.
So people want to keep chatting to Richard Candy.
Let me see. I will put up a little summary. Yeah, we don't have to. Yeah.
Just one quick question, Richard. I mean, you showed this schematic spectrum.
This one here, yeah.
Which, where the k to minus 5/3 is commonly interpreted as an inverse, representing an inverse.
This is sort of isotropic down here, and then
it's isotropic down there.
Yeah, and then it becomes anisotropic.
Well, in which energy transfers are predominantly up.
Yeah,
scale,
yeah.
Because the forcing scale is mm-hmm. the far right hand side. Now, what happens when KF becomes roughly similar to K Rhines?
So I'm saying you can take this KF all the way up to K Rhines, and you'll still get strong staircase formation.
But do you still get a K to the minus 5?
You won't get it. There'll be no. It will just continue down to a dissipation range. I don't hold any. A real strong belief in this minus 5 or even the minus 5/3 in the isotropic range, but for other reasons that we can talk about. But this is purely phenomenological.
Is there a rationale for the 5 exponent here, or it's just a empirical?
Peter could probably talk about that.
Well,
and Boris has mentioned that.
The sort of Galperin-Sukuriansky line is that the minus 5 is only representative of the jets. And the dynamics are therefore considerably different, and that's because the jets are believed to be jets, forced essentially by these spectrally non-local.
But the trouble is, if you have a perfect staircase,
so
that
it's only an empirical fact. There is no parameter.
I have to say, I
should be minus. It should be minus 4. Minus 4 is the step. So if you have a perfect staircase, that, then this slope will be minus 4, right, just because of the jumps.
And minus 4 from the superposition of the Rossby waves. Did you take the spectra of Rossby waves?
With Rossby waves on it?
Yeah, so minus 5.
I don't know. That's not the, yeah. Okay, so I think we have to leave it there, right?
Anybody wants to keep chatting to Richard can. So the rest of us, 15 minutes for coffee, and then we're going to start again with the second discussion, which is related to the discussion.